Mr. President, thank you for coming to appear before our lowly committee. We appreciate your esteemed presence here.
Thank you. My name is Peter Courtney. I live at 2925 Allenview Drive, Northeast Salem, 97303. I'm state senator. My district's 11, which includes portions of Salem and all of yours. Thank you, Your Honor. I want me to come before your Committee of Human Services and Women's Wellness here in the House. This is a resolution to start the Hood to Coast Relay, which was started some 27 years ago, and has reached the point now where it is now touted in things like New York Times and London Runners Magazine. Runners come from 49 states this year's race, which will be August 22nd and 23rd. 29 states and 35 foreign countries. It's become the world's greatest relay, and it's had significant contributions to our state, to tourism because of that. Economic development is also a major player in Hood to Coast. It partners with communities along the way, boosters, clubs, high schools who let you sleep in on the resting mats, take showers. I can talk about these things because I've done 14. I know you can't look at me and figure out how I did it. I'm scheduled to do a 15th one, but I'm very familiar with these high schools and these communities along the way. The area of Scuppoose High School, it helped with their sports marketing, as they say, St. Highlands High School, Jewel High School. There's also a grade school in Seaside. I don't remember the name, but also a major players in terms of helping the runners along the way. Community development last year spanned their ages 14 to 82. It's a family event. You'll see families themselves enter the event. This year they'll have the first ever totally blind team that will attempt to run Hood to Coast. The Hood to Coast Timberline to Seaside consists of 12 runners. They also had two events starting in Portland to the Hood to Coast, Portland to Coast, one walking event as well as the high school cross-country event. So it combines all those features. There's some 3,500 volunteers. Each team that comes from within 50 miles of Portland must come up with three volunteers. My team, Peter and the Wolves, must come up with three volunteers. And I think the volunteers are more a part of it than the runners because they are truly gods. You do not mess with volunteers in Hood to Coast or you get disqualified real quickly. As well, you should. They raised $10,000 during the recent Oregon floods for the Red Cross. Last year, they donated over $225,000 to the American Cancer Society. This year they're working also to raise even much more than that, the Cancer Society. As they say, there are 17,400 runners that participate in walkers. This year, unfortunately, over 700 teams were turned away. The demand for this race is so great that the opening date in which you can apply to be in this race, you have to do it by mail. That's the only way you can apply. And so you have a postmark, like this year, I think it was October 19th. The next day, when all the applications start to come into the office, they were well over what they could accept. So the demand is very, very great. So the event was started by an individual who went to North Salem High School, University of Oregon, Bob Foote. Years ago, it was just a simple event. It went from Timberline to Pacific City. It has changed dramatically since then, constantly working to try to accommodate the communities they run through as well as the state of Oregon. And so the Senate, through unanimous vote, I was surprised, 30-0, decided to support the events in a current resolution 24. And so I thank you for even considering this resolution, Chair Toomey.
Thank you, ma'am.
I'm very embarrassed. I always, always, always leave behind me written testimony, and I don't have that written testimony. It's been printed, but I'll make that part of the record. Is it now coming?
It's magic.
Oh, there's my Sasha. Oh, there she is. So, thank you, Sasha. You bailed me out. So I'm very pleased that that caught up because I do think that's important. So that's part of the record, too. Thank you, Sasha. And it's officially addressed to the committee. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. President. Any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. President, 14 times, tell me which leg you like the best.
Well, I run Lake 1, which is Timberline down to Government Camp. That's 6 miles. It's a drop of 2,000 feet. And the reason I run it is I don't want to destroy any other members of my team because it will destroy you. It is by far the worst leg, and it destroys me. And I don't walk for 4 days after this run. And the leg run is now considered out of all the legs to be the most difficult because you're dropping 2,000 feet over 6 miles, and it just destroys you. But I love the co-ed teams. I think the co-ed teams have the most fun. There's 12 members, 6 men and 6 women. And I'm the oldest guy. I don't want to tell you how old I am. I'm embarrassed about that because I have 20-year-old Cheetahs on my team. I have 30-year-old Whippets on my team. I have 40-year-old Greyhounds on my team. I have 50-year-old Panthers on my team. And then we have a, we won't even talk about somebody else in terms of how slow he is, but I always run leg one, which is the last 6 years, and I will run that again simply because you have to run two more legs after that, and literally, I'm willing to take dope, contraband, anything if I could to try to deal with it. So that's the leg I run, leg one. I don't know if you're familiar with that leg, but it's a brutal leg. So you've run it, I guess.
Yes.
You know, you, so you've run leg one?
No, two.
Got it.
Yes. Just one more question.
All right.
So what's your average mile then?
You mean speed-wise?
Yes.
You know, they don't tell me what it is. I just get back in the van and we go from there. You're going to embarrass me. You know, I may be faster than you're thinking. I do want to get lighter and faster, and I'm getting heavier and slower. But I have, you mean ever or just last year?
Madam Chair, follow up. Mr. President, the one that you would be proud to share with us.
All right. I have averaged 7 minutes a mile on leg one. And I've paid dearly for that.
Yes.
So, yeah. So I have. But that's, yeah, I have. That's, I mean, I'm not, you asked me, so I told you, but I didn't. You know.
I've always thought that, Madam Chair and committee members, off that first leg, it seems like you smell burnt rubber coming down off of that 2,000 drop.
Well, yeah, you have to. Yeah, I have an athletic trainer who takes my feet, it sort of takes an hour to take my feet because of blisters and all kinds of other stuff. So you put all kinds of balm on, you do everything you can.
Any other questions or comments to this esteemed visitor from the other chamber?
I'm just in awe, Madam Chair. I can't offer anything.
Thank
walk
you.
Walk is as popular as the run. You know, you've heard about the walk. People love that walk. It starts in Portland at 4 o'clock in the morning, Delta Park. They walk from Portland to Seaside. That's as popular as actually the run. I mean, there are people in this building, they just fight like crazy to get on the team. So it's not just the run, you understand. It's that has become as much a part of Hood to Coast as the actual Timberline in Seaside. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. We will close the work session on... I was going to close the public hearing on SCR 24 and open up the work session on SCR 24.
Madam Chair, I move SCR 24 to the floor with the be adopted recommendation.
Representative Olson moves SCR 24 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Joanne, wherever you are, would you take the roll? Or can we just say by affirmation? Is that clear? Yeah. Any dissent accepted by affirmation? So the motion passes and SCR is adopted. And Representative Olson, would you share this on the floor?
Sure. I'd love to.
All right. We open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1061A.
I can go through a little bit here. Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 1061A comes out of your Senate Services to Seniors and People with Disabilities Committee. It was also worked on in conjunction with the subcommittee on your subcommittee on services and for disabilities. Basically, the bill is a planning bill that requires DHS to do cost projections and planning for the next legislative assembly to actually present information early, and we cover a host of issues that the committee, that a work group basically developed last interim, and then things were added, issues and areas over the course of the committee, and Representative Cowan was paramount in this bill as well. So I will also defer to her if there's anything to add on that.
Do you wish to add anything, Representative Cowan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just that this bill sets a blueprint for where we're going down the road with the attempts to bolster
the provisions of our long-term care system. It's one that we've worked on long and hard. You folks have heard probably more than you ever want to hear from me on this subject, so I will mercifully not go into all the provisions today. It is possible that Senator Morissette would like to add.
Absolutely. Senator, I didn't realize that you were still here.
Yeah. You didn't think I was here for the coach.
No, but I thought you said you were leaving.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, and I just want to thank the subcommittee for all their hard work. And it is a planning bill, and in lean times, which I'm afraid we're going to be facing, it's more important than ever to get the community together. We're looking at what's called a new front door, which is a single point of entry for each community into the system. And that includes non-Medicaid people, seniors who want information are having a difficult time finding it in some areas, and so this is to kind of close those gaps. And so I do really appreciate the work that you have all put in on it, so thank you very much.
And we certainly appreciate the work that you've put in on it. Thank you, Senator. James Taves, I think, is here and would like to speak with us. And if there is anyone else, would you let us know if you're interested in speaking today? I'm sorry. Art Towers, I've got looking at the wrong name. I'm sorry, Art, to see you there. James, good morning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, James Taves from the Department of Human Services. I'll be very brief since quite a few of you have heard a lot about this bill in previous committee meetings and subcommittee meetings. Obviously, most of the attention recently has been focused on the beginning of almost a breakdown of our long-term care system that's reimbursed by Medicaid. Oregon, again, historically developed a really robust community-based care system with the lowest institutional rates in the country and lots of options for seniors and people with disabilities in small community settings or in their own homes. And that's been a historic partnership both between people who can privately pay with their own resources and then people who are poor and ultimately spin down and need to be reimbursed by Medicaid. And within the last several years, we've seen a very dramatic shift towards the private pay side, where providers who can receive much higher reimbursement rates are withdrawing from the Medicaid program, and that's leaving us with a very dramatic gap in services and correspondingly, for the first time in 20 years, an increase in nursing home usage, which obviously is the most expensive, least desired service setting for seniors and people with disabilities. So part of the long-range planning that you've been struggling with, that we've been struggling with, is to address the immediate problem of plugging part of the gap around Medicaid capacity. But it's not as simple as that. It's not simply a rate issue. It's a real complex issue that has to do with all the demographic changes that are going to occur over the next 20 years. So that's why we started, the governor 2 years ago started a long-range planning process, which really was sort of starting the conversation, looking at a lot of data across Oregon communities and how Oregon's going to age. And then there was a budget note this last session, and then this bill really codifies a whole series of things of budget notes, previous ideas, lots of input from the stakeholders that Representative Cowan and Senator Morissette pulled together. And I think it's a very, very good bill, and as Representative Cowan called it, really a blueprint. And much of it will focus not just on paid care or Medicaid care, but also really shifting Oregon's responsibility to the public at large, so we begin to really equip seniors and people with disabilities long before they need paid public care with counseling and support and options in terms of how they can support themselves in their own homes and whether or not they should consider long-term care insurance and all of this kind of things, where we provide very little outreach. We basically are at the receiving end when people have spent down, come out of the hospital, broken a hip, suddenly need long-term care. We do very little in that broader public mission of really helping people understand how to plan for their future. So that's much of the goal that, again, is represented in these in this bill. Our goal in terms of time frames, really section one is the comprehensive long-range plan and the elements that are to be included in that. Our goal is to have a draft ready by July 1st of this year, and between now and then, with lots of stakeholder input sessions, including public forums around the state, so that we can bring something to you that's had a lot of interaction with stakeholders and interested persons before that. So that's our goal on section one. Section two is a series of additional items to be priced by the department, cost projections to be done, items that may or may not be included in the comprehensive plan. That really remains to be seen as we go into the next 2009-2011 budget cycle. And our goal there is that we'll meet with stakeholder groups throughout the summer months, get a lot of their assumptions about the pricing and projections for these different service elements, and that we'll have those ready by September 1st. There was a lot of interest we discussed on the Senate side in having these ideas ready to go and have interim legislative committees briefed well in advance so that you all can make decisions independent of what we may end up recommending in the governor's recommended budget. So we think it's a great bill. We're excited to be part of this process, and we really thank you for your support of this.
Thank you, James. Any questions? Yes, of course, Kim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can't find this in the bill. I wonder, there's somebody quoted that we're going to try through this bill, which I support, and I am very glad we're doing this. So, to Representative Cowan, I don't think you've talked too much. I like all your hard work on this, but I just wanted to go over this point that this bill would provide levels sufficient to maintain the capacity of all residents, residential care facilities, and adult foster homes, providing Medicaid services to seniors and people with physical disabilities. I don't know if that's a quote from the bill or not. I couldn't find it. But if that is at least an intention, if not the actual words in the bill, I wondered if you could give a quick response to when we do that, which we need to do, obviously, and we've heard testimony why, because of the disparity. What do you anticipate when putting together this kind of a plan that the federal or Medicaid response is going to be to that? Because just because we set the rates where they should be doesn't mean it's going to fix the problem. Is there going to be a pushback, or how does that happen from the federal government?
Representative Gilliam, I think you're reading from something from the Multnomah County Board of County Commissioners on February 18th.
I am. Yeah. I wish you didn't look over my stuff.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, that was the unamended version they made reference to in the A.M. Gross version that we have now. That section that they're referencing, the letter was removed because that's going to be handled in Ways and Means Committee. Correct.
So it's not a good question.
Excellent question.
Representative, not to respond to that. I would be happy to. And it is a good question because it started out in the bill, and the first form of the edict that you saw did include addressing the Medicaid rates to assisted living facilities, adult foster care, and residential care. That was the old Section 1, which was amended out on the Senate side in order to sort of change the conversation that we have about it from a fiscal perspective. But I think it's important to note that while this bill is primarily a planning document, the rest of that question is alive and well in the Ways and Means process being handled through the Department of Human Services Rebalance Plan, which I'm sure Mr. Taves can address in more detail if you wish. But we are confident that we will see that rate increase that will lessen the disparity between private pay and our state rates. As part of that discussion, the industry, the providers of assisted living, adult foster care, have been very, very cooperative in the conversation and have come up with some language that's currently being worked about what they will assure in terms of
increasing access to those beds. So we're going to come out with a full package before this is over. It just doesn't happen to be addressed in this specific bill.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, the federal government actually requires that our Medicaid reimbursement rates be sufficient to assure access. So as long as we do anything that's reasonable, they will provide the federal match as part of that rate setting. So I don't really anticipate any major problems on the federal side. It's really our ability to redesign a rate methodology that stays partially competitive with private pay. I don't think we'll ever achieve 100% of private pay, or we'd always just be chasing changes in the private pay rates. And of course, with the demographic changes, that private pay market's just going to explode. So we're at the end of that sort of competition with the state trying to fill in a gap. I think our hope with a rate setting methodology that stays competitive is it's benchmarked as a certain percentage against private pay that's updated, and we actually have an independent contract now with a group that's doing a very detailed market study across the state in 8 geographic regions. So part of our goal is to set a rate that has some level of percentage-wise, at least, stays in the ballpark with private pay. And then based on both Ways and Means recommendations and what's in this bill, that we also then have a series of add-ons for real high-complexity care, which our community-based system now is having real problems serving people with Alzheimer's and some very complex needs. And again, the alternative, if we don't do something, is they all go to nursing homes at hugely expensive costs and the setting that most people don't want as a first choice. So I don't anticipate real problems with the federal government, although they're trying to crunch down the Medicaid program from all kinds of different angles, so who knows what.
Thank you.
Dave, yes,
Mr. James, the only thing I ask you to do is when you do these tours around the state, is that you inform the legislators and the areas you're going to, that you're going to be there so that wherever you go, they can participate, and on this, at least inform all of this committee where you're going as an overall plan. Because I think it's important that we participate.
I'd be delighted to do that.
Good. Good point. Anyone else? All right.
Thank you.
Arthur Towers?
For the record, my name is Arthur Towers, Political Director for Service Employees Union Local 503. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. First of all, we really just want to register our support and thank everybody involved for their good work on this legislation, Senator Morissette, the agency, members of the subcommittee, and especially Representative Cowan for her leadership on this issue. As you know, we represent nearly 10,000 home care workers, about 3,700 adult foster care workers, and nearly 1,000 nursing home workers who are frontline care providers for elderly and people with disabilities. So we strongly support this legislation. I do want to remind folks that this is desperately needed because even now in this dire budget situation that we're in, we're looking at more disinvestment in programs for seniors and people with disabilities. Our union is fighting very hard in the Ways and Means process to improve funding, but again, with the DHS rebalance, we're looking at losses of services here, or reductions in expenditures, let me put it that way. And so we think that this bill is a very good step towards remedying that situation in the future, because as Representative Cowan puts it, we desperately need a blueprint for moving forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Arthur. Any questions of this witness? All right, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak on this bill? Seeing no one, I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 1061, and I will open up a work session on Senate Bill 1061. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And please, if I could just take a moment to thank the committee for all of the
the hard work and interest on this bill. I truly do appreciate the support that you've given me as a committee in developing this. So it is with a great deal of pleasure that I would move Senate Bill 1061A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cowan moves Senate Bill 1061 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. There seems to be a discussion among these. Would you like to make that public?
Madam Chair, she broke script.
I'm going to take care of it now.
Sorry.
Not in front of witnesses.
Sorry, Madam Chair. We should be separated at this moment.
All right. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, Joanne, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Miller? Aye. Representative Johnson? Aye. Representative Russell? Aye. Representative Gilliam? Aye. Representative Culkin? Aye. Representative Maurer? Aye. Representative Olson? Yes. Chair Clement? Aye.
Having received the constitutional majority, Senate Bill 1061A passes. And congratulations, team. Good job.
I stand chastised for the moment.
Thank you very much. I close the work session on Senate Bill 1061. Oh, Carrier Jean, would you mind carrying that?
I could do that for you, ma'am. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry I had to step out. Is the subcommittee going to continue in the interim? I'm just curious.
I hadn't thought of it.
I don't know.
Good question. We would have to go to the speaker.
Madam Chair, if the subcommittee is willing to continue and the speaker blesses it, I would be delighted to have this conversation go on.
I think that would be very appropriate, so we will discuss it with the speaker. Thank you. Okay, we're going to open up an informational hearing on Oregon Breast and Cervical Cancer Screening Program update. Okay, it's good to see you again. Hi, Katie.
Thank you very much, Chair Tomei. For the record, my name is Catherine Bradley. I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health, and within the Office of Family Health is the Women's and Reproductive Health section. It is my pleasure today to give you an update on Oregon's Breast and Cervical Cancer Detection Program. I have a brief overview that I'd like to give, a handout that I think has more detailed information. I know that this committee has tracked the work that Oregon's Breast and Cervical Cancer Detection Program has been doing over the last decade, so I wanted to bring to you a couple of the highlights of, I think, some of the significant changes that truly have rebased this program and is making it much more accessible and available to Oregon's women and supports the providers that need to be there in this partnership. This program is a 10-year-old program. It is critically needed in Oregon for breast and cervical cancer screening because we still rank second nationally for breast cancer incidence in the country. It provides help for low-income, uninsured, and medically underinsured women and provides access for screening for early detection for breast and cervical cancers, and then if needed can give them presumptive eligibility onto OHP if cancer is detected. In general, we see approximately about 6,000 clients a year, although I would state that probably we have an assumption that there may be over 40,000 clients that may potentially be able to access these services. It was originally designed over the last 10 years as being a county-based service, so the counties had their own infrastructure and administration and management and referral processes. In 2006, due to cutbacks with the CDC, the decision was to centralize it at the state, and then a rollback occurred in which services were centralized at the state level. Clearly, the structures and the supports and the staff expertise needed to manage a centralized program differ than if it's decentralized through subcontracts. And the decision last summer was made in partnership with our county partners to transfer the program from the Office of Disease Prevention and Epidemiology to our office, the Office of Family Health. And the intent of that really was that in our office, we do a tremendous amount of program administration administration between WIC, family planning, home visiting. We've got a lot of established structures for dealing with that and felt that we could provide better support for the program. We have done a tremendous amount of work over the last 4 or 5 months. The initial focus was to do a priority activity with the claims processing because that had lagged significantly. I'm here to tell you that in about a 4 month period of time, reflecting a tremendous amount of work from the staff, over 2,000 claims were processed and corresponding payments were made, and a significant backlog going back 18 months was eliminated. We have developed a new claims database that actually moves it from being a manual process to an automated process, which is certainly appropriate for this time. And the new claims database was rolled out in January, and that means that we'll be able to do bi-monthly payments, and we do get about 600 to 800 claims a week, and we'll be able to process those efficiently and get them back out to our providers. We, in terms of our communication structure, we've also changed that. Previously, there was a 800 toll line that came essentially to an answering machine within the state, and then we had an individual whose full-time role it was to sort of respond to that and try and connect with people, but the initial contact was an answering machine. We have transferred that over to SafeNet, which is a 1-800 statewide system that provides information and referral. It's available 12 hours a day, Monday through Friday, and even has the ability for referrals in over 75 languages. We've been working closely with SafeNet for some time in maternal child health and felt this was a more accurate way to sort of set up communication processes, which means if a woman calls from a county for information, she can reach someone and begin the conversation with a real person, which we felt was pretty critical. We do have a process we'll be setting up in terms of evaluation to be sure that this meets the need that we need to have for both the clients as well as for our providers. And then the other thing that we've done is that we are fully staffed finally. Because of the amount of program transition, there was greater than 50% turnover in the state staff, and we now are fully staffed with a new program manager and someone to do with outreach and to work with our provider and billing processes. The next steps over the next 6 months, we still do have quite a bit of program work to do to really get it rebased so it's a strong and cost-effective mechanism at the state level. We are designing a web-based system so that providers will be able to complete client enrollment and submit data and invoices via the web. Initial work on that has begun, and we are anticipating we'll be ready for testing later this spring. When we do a launch, we'll do a regional training process that we've used with other programs in our office. It's been very effective in terms of working with providers across the state. The second thing we're working on is we are changing the way we've got a contract structured to a medical services agreement. If we use the standard DHS template for a contract, it's 40 plus pages and details all of the program elements. There's no need to do that. In most of our other programs, we have a set of OARs that establish the structure of the program, and then we just have a medical services agreement with the provider, and we are moving to that. And that provider agreement is approximately 6 pages and will be so much more user-friendly for our providers. And then we are redrafting, or actually drafting, a set of OARs for the program, and we are going to be working with our provider work group, which represents providers from the community, in review of those OARs, as we are with many of these other steps, to make sure that what we are developing works well for the providers. But the real point of this is outreach, and it's really focusing on those priority populations that we need to see. We are spending, and we'll spend approximately with last year and this year, probably about a 12-month period of time restructuring the program. But then we can really partner with the Susan G. Komen Foundation and our county partners to really focus on those priority populations to reduce health disparities. And our primary focuses with this are women in rural areas, the underinsured, and those are really the areas we're trying to get the most focus on, because that's really what this is about. We can see approximately 7,000 clients. We have seen about 5 to 6,000 a year. We fully anticipate being able to see and refer all the clients that we can this year, and then we intend to expand this program over the next couple of years to begin to address the needs that are here. Thank you very much, and I'm open for questions.
Thank you, Catherine.
Any questions for this witness?
Yes, madam.
I thought you were
No, no, I've got lots of questions, but I'm going to let Representative Gilliam go first.
If you're not up to you, it's up to the chair.
It is, but I'm being kind and deferring to her.
Thank you. Would you go over that figure again in Oregon? Did you say, is it combined breast and ovarian or just breast cancer, that we are second in occurrences in the nation?
It's a combination of breast and cervical cancer that we are ranked second in the nation.
And is that per capita? Is that how we do that?
I'm not sure. So what I would suggest is perhaps I get a better definition of that and respond back to you.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for asking that. That is bringing in my question too. That's astounding. Representative Lauer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I have a series of questions.
Go.
Okay, thank you. I asked Chair Tomei to have this informational hearing because I have a conflict in this. And a small medical clinic, and we were contracted to be a BCCP provider. And when the program was fine, it was somewhat burdensome for us, but it was a service. And when it transferred to the state, we received a packet with a 40-page contract as compared to the 6-page contract or 4-page that we had with Jackson County. And I read the contract. And there was no way I was ever going to sign that contract. It increased my liability requirements by tenfold from what I currently have, and it actually made me somewhat angry. I'm looking at you, but I'm not blaming. It made me somewhat angry that this transition was costing services. And so I started asking some questions. And some of the things I heard were not very good. And one of the questions I asked, well, what is the administration cost for the program? And the response was 40%. 40% in admin costs. And my jaw, after I picked up my jaw off the floor, I said, that is unacceptable. And can you explain it? And the explanation was that in this transition period, going from county to state, and to make the program more streamlined, we were focusing on making those changes, putting stuff online, reviewing the contract structure, claims processing, and that was a significant cost this year. But the expectation was that our admin costs would be something hopefully less than 10%. Family planning, I believe, is at 9%. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I was quite relieved to hear that. And continue to ask questions. How many providers did we lose as a matter of this in this transition? We really never got a very good answer how many we lost. Then I asked nationally what's going on with BCCP. And talked with the NCSL, National Conference for State Legislators, and asked how are states funded, and was quite surprised to find that Oregon puts zero general fund dollars into this program, and most states, in fact, do put some general fund dollars into the program, and that we are funded solely through grants. Mm-hmm. And I would think that as a priority, maybe the state needs to look at least something, as a good faith effort. And I also believe that this is actually a great way to get women tied into primary care. That in our experience, a lot of women who were uninsured would come into our clinic, we would get referred from Jackson County, and I'm not quite sure how the referral process would work, but we would get referred from Jackson County, and these women would live locally, have no primary care provider, they would come into our office, we would perform services, and in that process, we would establish them as a patient in our clinic so that they found a primary care home. And so it was a great point of access, it was a great service, and I was very pleased to be a part of the program. My hope and my expectation is that in the coming months, as this gets rolled out, that I will again be able to contract with the state and become a provider again. And we don't do it to make money, because quite frankly, like Medicaid services, every time we provide a service, it doesn't quite cover our costs. But that's, you know, and that is just part of what we do as a rural health clinic. So that's really not the issue. I have one question about, and I'm going to shift to a couple questions. The claim submission process that you're working on, are the providers going to be able to submit claims individually online? Or is there some batch process?
Chair Tulane, Representative Maurer, I actually am not sure of the specifics on that, so I can respond back to you.
Okay. I hope the answer is we can do it either way, individually, okay, or batch.
So, if I may, Chair Tulane, what we are doing and what we've done very successfully in other programs in our office is that all of this work is actually working with a provider work group. So we constituted a provider work group. So as we're putting together processes, it really is reflective of what the needs are in the community, mm-hmm, and it's not done as a small group of state people with good intentions. And so that's really stood us in good stead. So I will follow up on that, but I would hope that it would reflect what the providers are asking.
Okay, thank you. And Madam Chair, just, I call this because this is such a huge issue in the state of Oregon, as your statistics cite, and that every chance we get, we need to let the public know that, A, this program exists, and encourage providers, if they can, to participate. And if you streamline the system, maybe they will be more likely to participate. So I think it's a great thing, and it just needs, you know, sunshine on. Thank you.
And we can have follow-up meetings regarding this issue as time goes on. We'll talk more about that. Any other questions of Catherine? Thank you so much, Catherine. Good luck on this program. And that is just an astounding statistic that Representative Gillian pointed out also. And I would really appreciate if you would let the rest of the committee know about that statistic.
Chair Tulane, thank you very much. And I would be remiss if I didn't also just, I wanted to publicly thank the manager of this program, Ryan Frischel, and her staff. They just did an outstanding job. And their focus really is to take down barriers and to make this be accessible to the providers, so that we can really reach the clients and expand that. And I've really been impressed with a very impressive group of folks which are very clear about their commitment.
Great. Thank you so much. Is there anyone else who wants to speak on this issue? If not, I will close the informational hearing on the breast and cervical cancer screening program and open up an informational hearing on child and family services review. Can people stay until 10? Is that going to be a problem? I don't get to 9:30. Okay, great. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Brian Johnston. I'm the Assistant Director of the Department of Human Services, Interim Assistant Director. And amongst my responsibilities in the division that I lead is child welfare. And so with your permission, what we'd like to do today is present two pieces of information for you. One has to do with the child and family services review that we've just had, and one has to do with the staffing the staffing study that was done on the child welfare workers. They actually fit quite nicely together. So with your indulgence.
Yes. And Brian, I guess I didn't make it clear, we also would like to hear at some point the report on the children in foster care using psychiatric drugs.
And we are prepared for that as well, Madam Chair. I just didn't realize we can go right into that seamlessly. I thought that we might carry that over till tomorrow.
That's fine. Whatever the committee cares to do. Yes.
At the end of January, the department received from the Federal Department of Health and Human Services Children's Bureau our second child and family services review. The first one took place in 2001, and the second one, the visit took place last September, and we just received the report this January. there were significant changes in the standards and approaches from the 2001 review into the 2007 review. And I want to put on the record that we support those changes. They elevated the standards. They made the they went from a 90% if you met a 90% standard, you were in conformance, to a 95% standard for being in conformance. They also changed another very significant piece. It had been when they were here in 2001 that the question was whether or not you contacted one of the parents of the child, and in 2007 the question was whether or not you contacted both parents of the child. So these are good things. These are the right directions. Having said that, there were seven outcomes that were studied by the evaluation team. Oregon met those standards in none of the seven outcomes. Each of the outcomes had associated items with it that were used to reach the conclusion about whether or not you reached the outcome. There were a total of 23 items associated with the seven outcomes. Of the 23 items, Oregon met the standard in three. So it was a... one would have to say it was an abysmal report, simply abysmal. We strive to reach those standards, and we run successful almost completely across the board. Not a single state has passed the standards thus far. Not a single state has met a significant number of the standards thus far. But we don't rest with, I wouldn't accept for my 11-year-old. Everyone is doing it, and I don't accept it for the state of Oregon either. So that's where we are. It's simply the realities. What I'd like to do is, Kathy Ledesma, who's seated to my right, is our lead person on this, and she is charged, amongst other things, with leading the effort to draft what's called the Program Improvement Plan, or PIP. And she is prepared to walk you through the chart that she just gave you.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Ledesma, and I'll provide a card afterwards with the correct spelling. I am the Assistant Administrator for the Office of Program Performance and Reporting at the Department of Human Services. We gave you two things this morning. One is that the quickest way that you can look at the results of the Child and Family Services Review, and then we've provided the executive summary, which is a little lengthier, and those results are listed on the final four pages of the report. Gives you a little more background and substance. Oh, I gave those back here. Thanks. The Child and Family Services reviews are qualitative reviews, not just desk audits of cases.
The microphone a bit away from you.
Sure. Thank you. Yes. They're qualitative reviews on site, as well as a look at the data that we actually submit to the federal government twice a year. Essentially, there are seven outcome, there are three different outcome types that are looked at: safety, two safety outcomes, two permanency outcomes, and three well-being outcomes. The chart will explain to you what we look at. Brian asked me this morning to talk about the performance between 2001 and 2007 and what each of those outcomes measure. Safety one takes a look at the timeliness of the initial contact once we receive a report of child maltreatment, abuse, or neglect. Do we, and in what percentage of the cases, do we actually respond according to our own administrative rules? There are two types of responses. There are immediate, within 24-hour responses, and there are five-day responses. You can see, the kind of checkered line, the lighter line is 2007. Our performance was between 60% and 70%. In most of the cases where we did not respond in a timely manner, those were the five-day responses. Those were less serious allegations, or allegations of less serious types of child maltreatment.
Madam Chair, by way of explanation, if someone were to call and say that we think Joan Smith's mother and father are doing drugs, and we had nothing other than an anonymous phone call, that's a
a less serious matter and you have up to 5 days to respond. If, on the other hand, someone were to say that Joan Smith came to school today with a black eye and said, Daddy did it, you have 24 hours to respond. The federal report found that we're very good within 24 hours, but that we don't follow our own rules within 5 days.
I'll continue. Safety, too, takes a look at the services that are provided to children to keep them safely at home and reducing the risk of harm to children in their own homes. And that is risk that is both before children come into care and after they're returned home. As you can see, our performance declined again between 2001 and 2007, and we were at about the 60% mark, meaning 40% of the children did not have services provided to them to keep them safely at home. Moving on to permanency, two permanency outcomes. Permanency one takes a look at how well the state does in identifying a permanency plan early on for a child, identifying an alternate permanency plan in case that that primary permanency plan fails, and then how timely we achieve that permanency for children. So, as you can see, again, our performance declined. One of the reasons that the performance declined so dramatically was a change in the way that the time to achievement of permanency was calculated by the federal government. They devised some very complex composites of timeliness to things like reunification and adoption. Where we showed the greatest decline against those new standards was in timeliness to achieve adoption. Permanency 2 takes a look at the quality of connections that the agency provides for children while they are in out-of-home care, and that's with their siblings, with their extended family. It's things like visits with families and how well we do in keeping children in close contact with their families and how well we monitor that. This is where we take a look at how frequently we visit children in care, how frequently we see each of the parents. Again, you can see there was a fairly dramatic decline in the state's performance last time we actually met the standard for this outcome. In well-being one, this is an area of great dramatic decline. It has to do with the availability, the ready availability of services to support families, to help families resolve the issues that brought their children into care, how quickly we do the assessments and are able to deliver those services to the adults in the case as well as to the children. As you can see, this was our area of least good performance. Well-being 2 specifically takes a look at education. We came close to the same mark we met last time, although there is a margin for improvement there as well. And then finally, well-being 3 takes a look at physical health, dental health, and mental health needs, and are they assessed and met in a timely way. With regard to physical health, we did very well. With regard to dental health, we were in the middle. Where we really fell down was meeting children's mental health needs. And so that's definitely an area that we need to improve in.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the health measures, for the dental and the mental health, was that an issue of available financing for the services, or was it access to available services?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, it's both.
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, these children are almost entirely eligible for Medicaid services reimbursement, and so it's it is more our dilemma in getting them timely service and timely seen. For example, take the mental health assessments. The federal law requires us to do 100% within 60 days, and we're currently at 31%, and yet their assessment would be covered. It's not a question of payment there. It's a question simply of we haven't held our own feet to the fire and gotten this done.
Can I follow up? On this one in particular, and then the others generally, did you see regional differences in the ability to meet the goals?
Yes. Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, please distribute those. The way this is evaluated is they sample a set number of cases in each jurisdiction, and they choose three counties. And so what they did was they took 17 cases from Marion County, 17 cases from Deschutes County, and 35. I believe it's 35. It's the graph is coming wrong. 31 cases from Multnomah County. And as you'll see, our performance varies significantly from county to county in all the standards. That's if I lay awake at night worrying about anything, it is the fact that the we have 36 counties in Oregon, and we have at least 37 different ways of responding to people when they come into one of our offices.
Thank
you.
I've got a question over here. I have
one
more.
Okay, now
we're
going
to go to Representative
Cotes. Okay, thank you. Do you, and I'm not really aware of the number of cases in different counties, but do you feel like Deschutes County would accurately reflect the experience of kids in more rural and frontier parts of the state? Does this give us a full picture of the experience of kids?
Madam Chair, Representative Felser, I would say no. I think Deschutes County is a is better than the rural county on the eastern side of the Cascades, and I would say it is about the same as the rural counties on the western side.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Hi, thanks for being here today. Well, one comment and then a question. I like this chart that shows us back in 2001, and I think we have to recall where we were in 2001 and what happened after that. Series of budget cuts, reorganization, a lot of upheaval within the department, you know, more intense cases perhaps caused by some of the issues around math. And I don't know if you've speculated how some of the cuts and some of the changes affected your ability to meet these goals, but that would be helpful, I think, as we try to move forward, because I do think some significant things happened in terms of funding and programmatic structure between 01 and 07 when you did this. I like the chart you have on page 17 and 18 that looks at the sub-indicators. Could you speak to the strengths that are listed here and how why we're doing well in foster care reentry, proximity of placement, and placement with siblings? Is there something specific we did? I'm just curious because we do have some high points in those areas.
Madam Chair, Representative Kodak, thank you for pointing out that we did have some strengths. Let's take a look at those in order. Item number 5 is foster care reentry. There's an upside and downside to foster care reentry. When we return children home, we're really, really sure that they're going to be safe there and that their needs are going to be met. That lowers the reentry rate. So we tend to err on the side of great caution when we return children home. That, as you would read in the executive summary, has some downsides, that we don't return children home perhaps as fast as other jurisdictions do. Moving on to proximity of placement, we just do really well in this, and that really speaks to how well, even though it's demonstrated in a different part of the report, we still could do better in developing out-of-home resources for children in their own communities, and how well we do in looking for relatives that are in close proximity to children so that they can remain in their communities. And then item 12, placement with siblings, that's always been a very, very high value in Oregon. I think through the years as we've taken a look at that, we've encouraged staff to allow placement with siblings to trump other things like proximity to the parents, keeping children in care. I know I've testified before this committee many times about our performance regarding siblings.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
thanks for being here and sharing this with us. I think we certainly have a lot of work to do. I wondered if you could speak a little bit to, I have a sense when we're looking at well-being 2 and well-being 3, whether children are being successful in their meeting their educational needs. And then I was struck when we talked about the weaknesses in the health needs and the particular weakness in the mental health arena. I suspect there's quite a correlation between adequate mental health treatment and the child's ability to attain educational goals. And I'm specifically thinking of, I was glad that we pointed out that the outcomes by region really don't address the rural areas. And we have some schools within our countywide school district who are more economically challenged areas and have a much higher percentage of foster care children placed in those districts, and particularly at the elementary level, they're struggling to meet everyone's needs with the staffing levels and the deficiencies, I guess, in available mental health services. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, let me make a number of points about that. First of all, the 2007 legislature allocated $10 million to the counties for the purpose of medical management, mental health medical management for folks either who have, are in danger of losing their children or have recently lost their children. So 60% of our cases are substance abuse driven, and mental health plays a huge component in that figure. And so the money that was allocated to the counties it will help us reach out and either prevent or speed up the taking of children or speed up the return of children to families once they're able to achieve a stabilized pattern of life. The same thing is true in the other topic we're about to discuss at some point, the psychotropic medications. That plays a role in this. The overuse of medications plays a role in the mental health for the children. In the 2011 legislature, one of the policy option packages that is in the works now, which we hope you'll get to consider, is an educational advocacy package, which would allow programs like, for example, not exclusively, but like the Juvenile Rights Project, to advocate for children, because school districts with all their own complications tend not to have either the resources, the ability, or the willingness in some instances to reach out to some of these children, and consequently they have denied them some of the access that they are otherwise entitled to. So it's a whole host of threads woven together to create this very unfortunate fabric, and we have to attack it fabric by fabric and thread by thread.
Thank you. Representative
Thanks, Madam Chair. A couple questions. Have I received a chart like this for my district, the county?
Madam Chair, Representative Mao, we do not have a chart like that for your district. This chart was prepared following the study done by the federal reviewers, and they only did three counties.
Is it possible to find out, the county? Because, quite frankly, I think it's if when we walk in and we say, can you explain this to us? It's a pretty decent response, I would suspect, because that should open up some conversations.
Madam Chair, Representative Mao, we can do that. We can. It will be our evaluation and not the outside evaluation, but we can prepare a chart like this for your county.
One more question, Madam Chair.
All right.
Thank you. I'm just looking on page 17, item number 15, under permanency outcome 2, relative placement. I just wanted to pick one thing out of there. I thought Oregon, I guess there seems to be a disconnect between our philosophy and Oregon's belief that the child should be with the relative. and that's permanent. But we're only achieving that 74% of the time. Is that how I'm reading it? And the feds want 95% of the time? Before you answer that, then sometimes, as we know, the family isn't always the right place to be. And
let me take a shot at this.
Is the federal standard messed up?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Bauer, it's not placement. It seeks and engages maternal and maternal relatives.
Can you read it as placement?
No. Okay. I am being corrected as I say that. So, thus falls the interim.
Well, I think that Brian, Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I think that Brian is right. I can't correct my boss in public. Brian is right. If we don't seek out those relatives and engage them in the case planning, how are they ever going to be, are we ever going to know that they are suitable resources for those children? That is where we fall down. In the first placement of the child into care, we don't do very well out of the gate seeking out those relatives right out of the gate. Later on, we do very well in seeking them out through a very protracted sort of process. We identify, we locate, we bring them in, and a lot of children end up in their permanent placements with their relatives. Oregon, as a matter of fact, is much higher than most states in the permanent placements with relatives. In the temporary placements, we're not. One of the barriers has been how we've paid relatives. That children who are not eligible for federal 4E funding until this last legislative session, we could not pay them, we could not provide the kind of support to those relatives that we could provide to strangers for caring for those same children.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I want to build on that for two reasons. One, first of all, we did. The 2007 legislature authorized us to make payments to, and keep in mind, the payments are not to the family. The payments are for the expenses of the child. So that's what the, so, you know, if you're a marginal, economically marginal family, the ability to take on another child may be simply beyond your economic abilities. And 4E allows us to give money, and you authorized that this last session. However, I would also point out that if you see, we did pretty well in this in 2001 and then not well in 2007, and the distinction was 2001, if we followed either parental line, we got a passing mark. 2007, we had to follow both maternal and paternal lines. And the paternal, I don't mean to be sexist in this beyond my normal level of sexism, but the paternal lines are very difficult to find in most of these, not in most, but in many of these situations. There's frequently a denial of paternity, and you not only chase down likely suspects, but then you have to engage in some investigative work to pursue it. And when we turn our attention to the child welfare staffing study, if you take one case and say the average case, this is 100% of the effort, and you make that a value of one, a case that has two parents involved for one of our caseworkers jumps up to a 1.45. It's like a case and a half when you have a second parent involved in terms of the amount of work that a caseworker has to do.
I have one first. So from what I heard, no state did well in this study in 07. How did we rank with other states?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Oregon was one of 17 states who had their federal review in 2007. This is a three-year cycle, so all of the states will be reviewed in 2008, 2009, 2010. So the results of those reviews, those 17 reviews, have not all been published yet, so we don't know where we fall. We do have a comparison for 2001, but to a large extent, that's not really a valid look at this point in time because the standards have changed and resources have changed.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kotev.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up on Representative Maurer's comment about data, if not the county level, the service district area level, I know, for example, Children First for Oregon has always published, or at least for the last 3 years in their annual data book, the foster care placement stability rate, which is directly one of the benchmarks that are used here. I know because these are case file reviews, you're not going to be able to probably track all of these benchmarks, but as many that we can produce at the SDA level that we could be tracking for all of us would be helpful, and that might be something the McKinsey folks are looking at. What are indicators and outcomes? And it'd be nice to tie them back to the federal review. I have a question about, thank you for the breakdown by region. We have some huge problems in Multnomah County. By virtue of just scale, more kids, more complex system, more resources in some ways, but also just a lot more pressures on the system. I'd be curious to know if you've considered any targeted efforts at Multnomah County particularly. We do need consistency across all the counties and all the SDAs. But as Multnomah County goes, so does the state's numbers. That's true for pretty much the child abuse reporting numbers, the placement stability numbers, it's just where there are more children, the metro area. So I would just throw that out there as something we might want to consider if we're really, not that I want to disadvantage any other county, we need consistency, but Multnomah County has some serious issues and they have had for years. And whether we're going to target staff there or additional training, whatever is needed, so they have the resources to do a better job. So I don't know if you've thought about that.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, thank you. This provides a really good segue for what are the next steps. What do we need to do? The next step is to file a program to build a program improvement plan and to submit that to the federal government later than April 7th. One of the approaches, one of the many strategies that we are using in the program improvement plan is to look geographically where there are the greatest needs to make improvements in specific areas. So Multnomah County has stronger performance in some areas than they do in others. Mm-hmm. Judge Nan Waller is part of the program improvement plan team, both for the state as well as for Multnomah County. We've asked each of the regional managers to take a look at their specific outcomes. And we do, by the way, have a dashboard that has six outcomes listed that are similar to these that you're looking at that are published by district. So we've asked the district managers to take a look at their own outcomes and to come up with some strategies locally to address where their greatest areas of needs are, in addition to those statewide strategies to address the gaps that we see statewide.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, you sound a theme that I have hit often in the speeches that I've been allowed to give on these subjects, and I would replay part of it here, which is if you look at the regional chart, you'll see that Marion County does reasonably well. Mm-hmm. The state of Oregon makes a tremendous mistake if it thinks the Department of Human Services is responsible for the state's children. We're not. We're a backstop, and we may be the last backstop. I hope not. We're one of the backstops. Marion County has a very active Commission on Children and Families. It has a very active philanthropic community. It has an active civic engagement that is doing a number of things that are very good for our kids and that are very good for the statistics that we keep track of here. I've asked each of the counties, each of my service districts, to relate to both their local county mental health directors and their Commission on Children and Families in ways that we haven't partnered before, because we have to do that. This has to be a much broader effort than simply the Department of Human Services. We've also applied with the statewide Commission on Children and Families for a CASE grant. CASE is, some of you are familiar with, a foundation that is very active in the arena of children foster care and child protection, etc. And we've met with them twice now and have been notified that we're going to be the recipient of a CASE grant, and they will give us not only money, but they give us expertise. And we will take several counties and run pilot projects, and Multnomah is one of them. But I'll reiterate the final thing I've raised earlier. We have to be a state that treats citizens in Lakeview the same way we treat citizens in Coos Bay and the same way we treat them in Hood River, because we don't do that now, and that's unacceptable.
And just very briefly, when we get to the workload discussion, if you could talk about some of the looks at
There is regionalization of, I think, the workload issues, and that could drive staffing differently than what our caseload ratio has done. So if we could remember to talk about that when we get to that. Thank you.
Representative, I'm going to ask my question first. Thanks. Brian, I'm stuck on S1 in Marion County at 89%, and I understand what you're saying about the Commission for Children, et cetera, and all the community assets that are out there for children and families. But if I understand that one correctly, that's timeliness of initial contact. So I'm not sure how the community assets would affect the timeliness of a case we're going. It doesn't.
Madam Chair, if you look on page 17 of the executive summary, you'll see that overall, statewide, timeliness of investigations was much lower than the repeat maltreatment, which is actually a misnomer here. It's lack of repeat maltreatment. Okay. So Marion County, when you look at the Marion County numbers, where the community comes into play is helping to prevent the repeat maltreatment. Mm-hmm. So the very things that Brian is talking about, the community wraparound services that are available in Marion County, help to prevent that repeat maltreatment. And that's where Marion County's performance is stellar.
I see. Great. That helps a lot. Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It is disturbing and upsetting to see all this. And it's also helpful to have folks here with great experience. Representative Kotek's experience shows when she talks about, if you compare, are we comparing 01? Yeah, 01 and 07. She pointed out that one of the things that has changed is the meth scourge in this state. My first question is, do you know how many cases were substance abuse related in 01? Because you said 60% of what you're dealing with now is substance abuse.
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, we do have that in our status of the children report, but didn't bring that over with us today. We'd be glad to get back with you.
Is it, you suspect it's not fair? This is not fair. Do you suspect it's dramatically lower?
Okay. Dramatically lower. Yeah. Dramatically.
Additional question? Brian, how long have you been over there?
This is my second tour of duty, Representative Gilliam. At the close of my first, we hired Dr. Bruce Goldberg to take over the department. And in my accident interview with Dr. Goldberg, I pointed out to him that I thought the amongst the areas that most needed to be updated was CAF. Unfortunately, his memory is as good as his spirit, and when it came time, he called me, and I'm now on my second tour of duty. I've been there since November 19th.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your answer, first of all, you're taking responsibility as you did the opening remarks, but the way you articulated where we are and the need for integrating partnerships and understanding this program in a larger context of our community is one of the reasons that I'm very glad you're over there, and I appreciate you doing it. I hope you'll stay and help us continue to turn this around, but I appreciate very much your work. I'm glad you're there. And I don't know if you enjoy being on this side or that side of the hearing thing more, but we're glad you're there.
Thank you, Representative, and I'll take the fifth.
Representative Gelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you very much for this presentation, and I really echo Representative Gilliam's appreciation of bringing difficult information and acknowledging the difficulty. I'm wondering about some of the related components in our human services programs and the investments that we make as a legislature that might help us prevent children from going into care in the first place. Representative Gilliam raised the issue of methamphetamine, and I'm wondering how our state's investment in substance abuse treatment and alcohol treatment might impact the types of scores that we see here and the health and safety of our children.
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, there's a lag time between the investments and the showing up, you know, the consequences of it. But one of the reasons we get marked down is the failure to offer an adequate array of services to parents. If we can't help them deal with whatever addiction they've encountered, then ultimately we wind up taking their children. So your investments, let me give you the statistic. Oregon takes approximately 7.1 children from per 100,000. Nationwide, that's at 4.1. So we're almost twice the nation's average in terms of removing children from homes. That's a, that's an egregious figure that cannot be maintained.
Madam Chair, may I follow up?
Yeah.
Thank you. Do you have a sense, a thumbnail sense of the wait time for a mother who perhaps needs substance abuse treatment when she enters into services in her efforts to keep her children or to get them back?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, I can't give you a number off the top of my head, but I can tell you this, that you saw this regional chart, it varies widely mm-hmm. by region.
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, there's nothing on the top of my head.
That was funny. a little bit. Sorry, could I have one more follow-up, please? Is there ever an issue of, and I don't mean to be sexist, women or men, mothers or fathers, needing to leave the area that their children are in order to find a slot for treatment where they end up going to different parts of the state? And do we have any mechanism for keeping their children with them, close to them, seeing them as they're obtaining that treatment?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, anecdotally, even though Oregon does offer some mother-child placement slots, it is in smaller proportion to the population needing those services than other states are able to offer. There are some model programs out of Multnomah County that actually led the nation, and somehow we have not funded those beds to the extent that they're needed in Oregon.
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, I would point out under the heading of the broad umbrella and the broad response, we have some wonderful programs mm-hmm. in the state of Oregon. I would point to Rita Sullivan in Medford. The program that she runs is marvelous and does a tremendous job of keeping children, which you and I would otherwise be supporting, with their mothers and giving them an opportunity, largely with their mothers. There's some fathers, but largely with mothers, and giving them an opportunity to grow into parenthood and to maintain that bond. One of the things, if I may, one of the things that scares me very much is amongst the ballot measures is a property crime initiative that would mandate certain prison sentence lengths. And it would mandate lengths of sentences that exceed the federal law's authorization before we terminate parental rights. And so after 13 months, we're supposed to move for termination. And if you've got someone on identity theft, which largely is a female crime if we can divide crimes by sexes, if you have someone on identity theft going away for 25 months, then they're going to lose their children. And you and I are going to absorb the cost of raising this child, and we're not going to do it as well. We just don't do it as well as parents and relatives.
One last follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Obviously, I think that substance abuse, drug abuse, all of the related issues like identity theft that come along with that are an issue that we have yet to fully grapple with in the legislature in terms of preventing these kids coming into the system in the first place. I would be interested in knowing if there's any way to gather data about the numbers of women that have children that go into the system due to substance abuse problems, their parental rights are terminated, and then they have more children and they continue this cycle with their substance abuse treatment issues continuing to be unmet. And if there might be a way to target some of these high-risk folks to provide them earlier the supports that they need so that we don't continue putting them through the trauma of losing their children, putting the state in the situation of continually taking children from the same family and putting the children through the trauma of losing their families. It's just such a tragedy that we aren't meeting these needs earlier on and causing this harm to kids in the process.
Madam Chair, Representative Gelzer, there are some programs here in Oregon which, again, are some model programs. Children of incarcerated parents is one that is very strong and that gets exactly at what you are suggesting here. In addition to that, there are three entities in Oregon, and I can't off the top of my head name what they are, who recently got methamphetamine grants from the federal government, from the Children's Bureau, again, aimed specifically at what you're talking about, at how do we, at a community level, provide the kinds of services that will keep those children connected with the families, keep us from taking more children into care, and reconnect those children with their parents, placement-wise, once the parents are released.
I know I've got a couple of other questions coming up and coming out of time, but you mentioned when a parent is incarcerated, either father or mother, at a certain point, then they will lose their parental rights. And what is that time of incarceration?
The federal government requirement, and one of the measures, is whether we've moved for a termination of parental rights within 13 months.
So if someone has a sentence of 20 months, 24 months, then you would have to move for...
Unless we have a permanency plan that's been approved by a judge that allows us to circumvent that federal requirement, we would have to move for termination.
It has to go to court first.
Right.
And how often is that done?
Madam Chair, there are, once we've established a permanency plan, an alternate permanency plan, every case is reviewed at a minimum every 6 months, statutorily every 6 months, but more often these days they're reviewed often as often as every 30 days to assess the progress of the parent toward meeting what is they're required to do.
And Madam Chair, you'd have to keep in mind at 6 months the custodial parent has chief status as a relative. So we have that, and we have all the bonding issues. So if you're, let's say that it's a baby, and you can see the arguments that are going to ensue. 6 months into the foster care arrangement, the foster parents have become relatives for legal purposes, and they have the argument of this child has bonded, and we're going to... The odds of successfully reuniting a mother who's been away for 24 months are going to be slim.
What I'd like, I guess, is some hard figures about that. When you see a parent, either a father or mother, who is going to be sentenced for so many years in prison, and some of it, I assume, is a minimum amount of prison, that won't get out for good behavior, then what happens? How many children then will stay in either foster care or go somewhere for permanent placement away from those parents?
Madam Chair, let us see if we can come up with something to address that.
Great.
May I distribute these work studies?
Sure. And while we're distributing, don't you have a question?
Well, I do, and it's slightly off target, but there's two people in this room that have had a very heavy heart the last week, Brian and I, as both graduates of Northern Illinois University, and Brian let me know that he was a graduate about a month ago or so, and I haven't said anything, but there was a huge tragedy, and I know... I don't know anybody involved with the incident, but I know people that still live there, and you know what an absolute tragedy. And Brian, I
share your grief, Representative Maher.
Representative Olson, I think you have a question.
Not really so much a question. Actually, a lot of the questions have already been answered. But I just want to point out that I haven't been on this work group for determining an alternative measure dealing with. Initiative petition 40 right now for the repeat property offenders. 44% of the population that's arrested for ID theft are women. So Criminal Justice Commission is estimating a little over 600 women are going to be added to the population of DOC as a result of that. We're talking about somewhere between a minimum sentence of 30 to 36 months. Mm-hmm. So that puts them in the ballpark of what they have to do with the adoption of the State Family Act for the 13-month period.
So if I understand this correctly, sir, if their minimum sentencing is 30 months, and they have children, then those children by law at this point will have to go through families,
absolutely,
and possibility of certainly foster care and possibility of permanent placement. So we're talking about a lot of children that will be coming into the system.
I have no idea, and that would actually be a good question, Madam Chair. I don't know, what are we looking at population-wise for children?
Madam Chair, Representative Holson, thank you for raising that. What we will try and do is see if the Department of Corrections can give us an idea of what that average woman looks like, and once we've done that, extrapolate and get you a number as to what we think and what we should plan for. This is the law of unintended consequences. Right. Here in Marion County, for example, when two citizens started a task force called No Meth, Not in My Neighborhood, and one of the things they were able to do was to raise slightly over $100,000, and they gave it to the sheriff to create a task force. And the task force did some work and went out and raided a bunch of homes. Well, the net effect was that what they were planning for was getting tough on meth. And what happened was we got this huge increase in number of children from meth-affected homes that suddenly went to the foster care system. And it was an unintended consequence of a very good idea. I would suggest that I would not use that label for the Property Crimes Initiative, but otherwise they're the same.
Just a comment, Madam Chair. I, by all means, I don't want to sound like I'm in opposition to the whole concept of wanting to be tough on crime, because most definitely I am there. But I also think you need to move forward with some, you know, common sense to some degree as well, and taking a look at the whole picture. We do have 149,000 signatures out there that have supported where IP40 is at right now. You know, those are things that you all have to take into consideration as we move forward with this. But this is huge.
Madam Chair?
I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank Representative Olson for his work on this issue and bringing his leadership around that total picture. And I just really appreciate the work you're doing on that.
Me too. And I think you have to keep in mind, I mean, this is not only going to be a huge financial burden for the state, but a huge burden for these children who are losing families. And I think that we just need to be aware of that and think about that.
Madam Chair, may I walk you through this? It would take about 12 minutes.
No. Sorry, we have people that are going. Can you come back tomorrow, please, and walk through this?
I'm glad to do that.
Thank you.
We could all read this, because I think ahead of time.
Yes, that's a great idea. Yeah. Read this ahead of time, and then we'll have...
And then we have homework? Well, we have a dull moment on the floor.
Close the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness. Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. We'll see you in the morning.